Judiciary Committee, the time is 1:41. President Mr. Schultz, Mr. Prejean, Mr. Gwinberg, Mr. Sun, Mr. Taylor, and Chairman North. We have three bills up before us today. Activate political campaign contributions. Activating the use of information for fingerprints. And activating the rights of physically and legally disabled persons. My assumption is that we can take care of two of these real fast. That's been a bit foolish assumption a time or two, but I think let's try to get those out of the way. I think Mr. Martin's bill can take us a little bit more time. So let's first of all take up 322, an act relating to the use of information from fingerprints of members of the Alaska Bar Association. If I could refresh members' memory on this. This was language we agreed to when we had the original bill before us. And then we realized we were going to take a change of title, and we had a Senate bill, couldn't change title, so we decided to shoot that one out and make our remedies in this one. That being the case, do I hear, is there any objection? We could have a motion on the subject. Mr. Gwinberg?
So moved.
Mr. Gwinberg moves the House Bill 322 with individual recommendations. Is there objection to that? Hearing no objection, House Bill 322 moves individual recommendations.
Did we take that? Are you chewing something? Tobacco?
Candy.
That's my intention. 393 will be up next. Again, the same memory path. I was just going to say, though, we had agreed to certain changes. Or actually, we had agreed with the original bill, but took out everything we thought was going to cost money. So we introduced 393 on that basis. Mr. Gwinberg has
Mr. Chairman, I've worked a lot with staff, and there's a sectional analysis here. Let me tell you what changes, let me go through just very briefly section by section. Section one puts in the jurors, which we took out, and this is the only fiscal note I intend, and it's $14,000 fiscal note. Actually, I think it's less, but I'm not going to quibble.
Yeah.
I think it should be about $9,000. Next.
That's the only fiscal note.
That should be. Next is the, says enforcement of this actually by the Human Rights Commission. You will recall that in House Bill 172, we left in the Human Rights Act that they would enforce this act. This just makes the two acts congruent by referencing back to the Human Rights Act. Section 3 is the prime difference, and it's just a drafting difference, between the House bill as introduced and the committee substitute. As you will recall, Mr. Chairman and members, there was a gigantic fiscal note from the court system because they said they'd have to renovate all their existing facilities. It was not our intent to do that in this bill. There's another bill that's making its way through the House now on access for the handicapped. And when that other bill passes, they can change this around as they wish. But what they did was, in this new subsection C, they specifically say that no alteration or remodeling is required. And then on page 2, lines 14 and 15, it is not unlawful to post notice that there may be difficulty entering some of these buildings by the handicapped. And by the way, there are already federal laws on the subject which carry their own penalties if buildings are not renovated. And this just is not intended to affect those federal acts. Then Section 4 is identical to, I believe, Section 12 in House Bill 172, but Michael Ford from Legislative Council felt that it was necessary to put this definition in here as well, in case something happened in House Bill 172 didn't pass, that there would be carried within this our own definition. It's identical language, and the reviser will deal with it if they're melded. And that's it, and I would move that the committee consider committee substitute.
Okay, the motion is before us. I've just got a quick question on Section 4. It seems to me we're asking for trouble because this is the subject of lively debate with definitions on the floor. And what if, this bill is not going to pass if the other one doesn't. It makes sense we're not going to pass this one and not the other one. The reverse may be.
I have no objection to excising that. He just felt that it was good form to have it in, but I think it's easier to pass if we make it a two-page bill rather than a three-page.
Yeah. Plus the fact that I don't like the possibility of us passing two bills that have two different definitions and you almost have to flip a coin to see which one prevails.
I would then, under those circumstances, move to strike Section 4.
Well, I know it is, there's an ice change on the floor. That was the subject of a whole lot of debate and a whole lot of heartburn on a lot of people's part, and I just hate to see us have the possibility of in and out with different definitions.
I move to strike section four.
Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, section four is struck. Is there a debate on other provisions of the bill?
I move the bill out with individual.
I want to object section one again.
That's a $14,000 this week, right?
Yeah, I just want to get into the, not the cost of doing it, it's just whether that type of person should be in a jury.
Mr. Chairman, look, we've discussed this already, and I think that there are some, there are certain cases in which somebody who's deaf or blind might not be appropriate, like if it's a question of eyewitness identification or copyright infringement of a Beatles song or something like that. But there are blind judges. There's a family court judge in Eureka, California, is blind.
And Robin knows
there's a judge in Maine who's blind, and jurors are now, this is a new trend, they're starting to be qualified.
Jurors are not trending to be blind.
Mr. Clarkson even has a picture of a statue in his office where it shows justice is blind. Blindfolded, excuse me. It's blindfolded.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me for making that outrageous.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. President.
I share Mr. Sun's concern. I mean, you know, just because there's a judge made in Wisconsin doesn't mean to me that we should have blind people on a jury when the facial reaction of a witness can be more eloquent than any words he ever speaks.
Well, I guess to follow that up is just to say that, you know, you can say there's exceptional cases that shouldn't be on it, but we're not saying that. We're saying that in those cases there, you've got to use some kind of peremptory, or you don't have a cause move anymore to take them off. But so you're not distinguishing between cases that the person can sit on. And I'm just thinking, I didn't know, don't do much criminal work, but PI work. I mean, I have never involved a PI case yet. I did involve some type of visual displays in terms of diagrams of the accident scene, pictures of the scene, videotape depositions, you know, on and on and on. But I guess I'm not convinced that that blind people should just sit on all juries at all times.
That there, you certainly can, and you will continue to be able to disqualify blind or deaf if there is, if they can't render a fair and impartial decision in the case. There is.
But you can't do it based on their disability.
You can't, because there are civil and criminal rules and statutes that permit you to disqualify for cause if there is any other reason. Catch-all phrase, any other reason under which the juror cannot render a fair and impartial decision. And if the person couldn't determine the accident scene or something like that, that's exactly the kind of reason that could be used, and you could get them for cause, you wouldn't have to bump them for a preemptive use of one of your preempts. And that's precisely what I'm going to suggest.
It's very common that you do allow people to get off under the provisions cited by Mr. Grunberg in the case of people who have a difficult time hearing. Because so much is done through sound that someone that's having a difficult time hearing will often raise that point to you during the voir dire and suggest that, and I'm having a hard time hearing you now, if these witnesses are going to talk any lower than what you folks are talking, I'm going to miss a part of this. And then you just kind of look at the two attorneys. If they have any problem with it, they'll let them off. You don't get into the problem, the real jackpot, you get down to the place where you select your too small and your panel. And that often occurs in Anchorage because they only select a limited number. And it may, in fact, occur also in Fairbanks. But usually, I don't think it would be a major problem. I have some concerns, just as both Mr. Sun and Mr. Pettijohn have indicated, that people with other and various handicaps, because you see, this is also going to, this is more encompassing than just blind or deaf people. This also encompasses people with emotional and mental handicaps.
Not this
provision won't?
No, just loss of hearing.
Okay. The other one.
Okay, the records should show that all members are present. Are you ready for the question?
What's the question?
The question is the adoption of page 72.
Move out with individual.
Well, I'd move we delete section one.
I would object.
Okay, Attorney General moved the removal of Section 1. Anyone want to debate that further? You ready to vote on it?
I'm ready.
Okay, as many as are in favor of deleting Section 1, raise your hands. Mr. Attorney General, Mr. Sun. As many as are opposed, raise your hands. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Watson, Mr. Greenberg, Mr. Miller.
I move the table with individual reference.
I think it was somebody wanted to make comments first. Mr. Taylor.
No, I was just voting.
Oh, you were just voting.
I had voted that you hadn't designated.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Mr. Taylor. And Mr. Plodgett.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being late. And if this has been discussed, I'll simply withdraw it. But on page 2, starting on line 16, subsection 3, appears to change the what I had perceived to be the present law to affirmatively. To eliminate the obligation to alter or remodel buildings. Is that the case? That's a step back.
And maybe this wasn't properly drafted, but I wanted to put the problem with the fiscal note on the bill before Don was that there was a $200,000 fiscal note, and that the court felt that by adding this language, this does not alter existing law because physical and mental disability is not in this section now, I'm quite sure. Section 250, am I right? Section 255, 1882-55 does not contain physical disability. And the reason, and if we had added physical or mental disability in here, the court system felt it would require the modification of structures, and that would cost minimum of $200,000. And I just don't want to have that. There's already a federal statute that requires it, and this is not to impair. Yeah.
There's also a state statute, 351015.
And this doesn't modify that.
To report and upgrading and remodeling.
At the moment, we just got the fiscal going on for over $65 million. Yeah. It would be required to come into compliance.
What is it, 35? Mr. Chairman, that's my concern. We just did receive this report. I didn't quite know where this fit in the general statutory framework. I know that Representative Gall is very concerned about access to buildings, and I didn't want to take a step backward here.
This does not.
Well, but, and it's not just the courts. I mean, to do something because of the court system is a mistake. This applies to all state buildings.
And there's the Gall bill on the subject.
Well, the new fiscal the new fiscal note is for 14,000.
Yeah, the present language in 255, Mr. Chairman.
We can see it.
Okay, you see it right now, it doesn't cover physical handicap.
Well, if we took out Section 3, what would happen?
$200,000 fiscal note.
But no, the court system, who did not even know about your proposed amendment, has already reduced that to zero.
Because they were assured that we were taking that out. That was if you contrast this fiscal note with the fiscal note on 172, this is only 14,000 because they were assured we were taking out the language that caused them to have to change their buildings, right? You have to look at the two fiscal notes.
But that language is an existing law right now that causes them to have to change. What am I missing?
Can I read? Having read the statute now, I'm even more concerned. Let me read 3510.015A, if I might. The department shall prepare, promulgate, and enforce regulations governing the construction of public buildings and facilities by and for the state, including the University of Alaska and its political subdivisions, whether financed in whole or in part by federal funds, to ensure that the public buildings and facilities are accessible to and usable by the physically handicapped, aged, or infirm. Ignoring the mental handicap question. That's A. E says, after June 25, 1976, no public building or facility in the state may be planned, designed, financed, constructed, open to public use, or otherwise placed in operation unless it meets the standards established under this section. Now, there's obviously a distinction between alteration and remodeling versus new construction, but I think that E imposes an affirmative obligation for every building after 1976 that it be accessible to the handicapped. And I think that's the opposite of what we're saying in subparagraph 3.
I think you misread it.
Hayden had a question, a point he wanted to make. I think I started this too.
I talked to the court system this morning asking for a fiscal note on this, this bill. And I just pointed out that, you know, there is a 3510 statute on the books that requires an upgrading, I think, is what, you know, it requires it for new construction, plus they're supposed to make a continual compliance, an attempted compliance with the handicap access. And that, you know, I just pointed out that's that statute, and said that, you know, they should take a new look at what is being said in the bill, and they came back with the fiscal note that just provided for the interpreter.
Oh, because the language I was concerned about, Mr. Chairman, before was in their fiscal note to the 172, which says, quote, providing access to court facilities and restrooms for disabled individuals will require remodeling of certain courts. The remodeling will provide barrier-free access routes to court buildings, expansion of jury boxes, and large toilet facilities for individuals in wheelchairs. For those locations where remodeling is feasible, the cost is estimated at $212,300. In a few locations, such as no modifications cannot be made except at substantial cost. Many urban courts are already equipped to handle disabled persons. And Mr. Caden, what you're saying is that that was wrong because they're already required to do it under this Title 35. Okay. Well, if that is the case, Mr. Chairman, I would move an amendment. And the amendment would be to, instead of the present Section 3, to insert the language from the Hess version of 172, which is contained in Section 13, and all that did was in the present existing language of 255 insert physical or mental disability, and we would use that in place of the entire Section 3, and it would say AS 1882-55 is amended to read, and I'm not going to worry about it. That makes it a lot easier.
Okay,
let me say that again. I move to substitute for present Section 3 the language contained in Section 13 of the Hess version of House Bill 172, which was, is right here.
How is that different from what's in HB 392?
Oh, let me see what's in there.
Which are you proposing to substitute?
I see. You're right, Hayden. I move that that we forget that, Doc. I move that instead of the committee substitute language for Section 3, we use the Section 3 language in the original 393.
Okay, so that's what I thought you were going
to realize we're moving quickly to get this bill out, but that doesn't work.
Well, we don't
want to
do
it
right, so we're going
to. Because the language in the proposed judiciary CS on line 13.5 through 14.5, your amendment would not take that in. I mean, it seems to me that's good.
Okay, then fine, let's leave that in. No problem.
What is your pleasure?
I would like to move it today. Mr. Adams said he would hold a hearing in finance on this tomorrow.
You got the schedule noted?
He put a...
I think he did a waiting the bill, that's right. On the basis of what we discussed on the floor.
That's what he was planning to do. I didn't see it in the calendar.
Okay.
Well,
that's
a good point.
I'm still trying to think this through. We also have 4780.010, which is rights of persons with handicap. Is that amended in this bill? It says in part, no otherwise qualified person by reason of having a handicap may be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity which receives public funds. Which, of course, I think is a great section. The only question is how that dovetails with this.
were you reading from?
4780.
Well, how did that dovetail with your reading?
Well, it doesn't track the language in the proposed judiciary CS. I haven't had a chance to look at that.
We haven't dealt, Mr. Chairman, we haven't dealt with this statute at all. I'm reluctant to get too far from the answer.
Take a step back. The proposal, the proposed judiciary substitute, the first half of subparagraph 3.
Mm-hmm. To refuse or deny?
Right. The reason the however clause is being added, I gather, is because of the fear that subparagraph 3 will require the alteration and remodeling of buildings.
Right.
And the current law does not do that.
1880 does not, because physically handicapped are not included.
I understand that, but 4780, whatever that is, does that affirmatively require the remodeling of buildings?
Well, what it says is no otherwise qualified person by reason of having a handicap may be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity which receives public funds. I don't think a building would fall under that, but I don't know. I've never seen this statute. I just don't know. This is in the handicapped and gifted section of the statutes.
Well, that's just interesting, Mr. Chairman, that you can inform me here that the 3510.015 provides a right for the physically handicapped, aged, or infirm to have public buildings and facilities that are usable by and accessible to them. But that is only reported construction. Sorry, I'm thinking out loud here and it's not going very well. But the difference between denying services and denying access to a building, I think that Title 47 relates to denying services. Title 35 relates to denying access to a building. You've taken both of them into subparagraph 3 by implying that the denial of services means denial of access to a building.
Look at the language of Section 3 of the original non-committee substitute. Yeah, you thought they had both.
Two.
The original bill.
There isn't. Yeah, there isn't.
There never was a 3.
Yeah, Section 3 here.
Well,
section 3. So the
no. See, if what we were originally planning to do was simply add it in there, and that language already says services, goods, facilities. So it covers everything. Seems to me, though, that what Mr. Caden said answers the question, that they have receded from the previous fiscal note and done a new fiscal note based on the existence which they recently learned of that Title 35 statute. So I think that it were okay by just taking Section 3 out of the original bill and inserting it into the committee substitute.
Yeah, I think 35 says that the department shall develop and maintain an inventory of all public buildings and facilities with respect to their compliance with this subsection A, which was the having no architectural barriers, and make an annual report to the governor and the legislature, and then continually upgrade and then prioritize work that needs to be done to conform. So it's an ongoing process. I don't.
Mr. Chairman, when Don first read that provision, it sounded to me as though all they were talking about in the first paragraph was new construction, and then in the second paragraph it appeared to run towards remodeling and upgrading. But the words that concluded the paragraph were, before it is opened to the public. which appeared to
opened
me...
Opened or opened?
Opened to the public. And it appeared to me as though that grandfathered in all the existing and only required them to make those changes when they went about major renovation or remodeling. And if it didn't grandfather it in, then why hasn't it been done since 1975? And why do we have a $65 million fiscal note? Because I think there's activist groups that would have enforced that had it been interpreted otherwise.
I think that's correct. There's a subsection B here that deals with existing. I think it speaks to existing facilities. And of course, it's obviously dependent on legislative appropriation to, you know, do that. But it requires the department to maintain an inventory of all buildings that are not accessible and prioritize the...
Let me ask you, Mr. Chairman, would Representative Clarkson, would you feel better if we made an amendment in the committee, using the committee substitute language, and making an amendment in, I'm looking at lines 19 through 21. However, this paragraph may not be construed to require alteration or remodeling of buildings or facilities owned or operated by the state or its political subdivisions to any extent not now required under existing law. To have the phrase, to any extent not now required under existing law. That should just keep this congruent with existing statutes.
Well, I think that would make me feel better. I guess I'm sort of thinking that this is sort of a patchwork that we're doing here. We now have rights of the handicap appearing in three different places in the statute. And it's just hard for me in 15 minutes here to see how they all work together. And I suppose the patchwork way to do it is just have every one of them refer to each other. So.
It's
canceled out, but
just don't forget this is going to other committees, and we don't regret this.
This is wrong. I just don't like this. Can I refresh my memory on the commitment
of any to getting this through this year?
The only commitment on the floor of the House, there was a lot of support for these.
Representative Gall was
interested. And so was Szymanski and a whole bunch. I would, Mr. Chairman, I think that it moved. Go a long way towards doing this, and I'll commit to work to do anything that's necessary to help in the Senate or whatever, to add the phrase on line 21 after subdivisions, to any extent not now required under existing law.
Mr.
Greenberg
moves that amendment. Is there objection to the amendment? No objection. I keep wondering, why don't we just drop this whole second sentence, starting with words, however?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was kind of my first look at it, too, but then it looks like you put a real positive factor in there that may mandate renovation of buildings.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was clearly, if I may, a political compromise in Title 35, that you got to do it for every building you build from now on, but you don't have to do it buildings already existing. And I think that compromise.
Unless you go back in and remodel.
Yeah, unless you go back.
Okay, well, that amendment has been adopted. We still have before us the motion to pass this committee substitute act.
Chairman, I don't want to belabor this, but I want to go back to Section 1 again.
Okay.
And get a clarification here because I've got the Criminal Rule 24. With me, and basically, if you want to get into challenge for cause, the issue that I brought up, it's under sub 3, which says that if the person shows a state of mind which will prevent him from rendering a just verdict. And that's a lot different than trying to challenge for cause for the fact that the person is blind and then won't be able to see the exhibit.
Mr. Chairman, I think that if that were read so narrowly as to exclude somebody who physically is incapable of digesting the information, there would be very significant constitutional problems with failing to bump that person for cause. Particularly in a criminal case, there is a right to a fair and impartial jury, and that's in the federal and state constitutions. And if some judge were to be so blind to the obvious, to coin a phrase, and so deaf to the needs of justice, that they would refuse to disqualify somebody because of a very narrow reading, that would be cause for reversal. having an unqualified juror and refusing to disqualify for cause voids the entire trial.
Well, I don't want to belabor it, but challenge for cause, number one challenge is that the person is not qualified by law to be a juror. And we are now making these people qualified by law. So we've made the step to the court and said these people are qualified to sit on a jury. And now you're coming back and saying that, well, we can argue in front of the judge that the legislature really didn't mean it, that if we can show that the person can't make up their mind because they're blind, can't see the evidence, we can get them off for cause. I think you're arguing against what the legislature's done.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
We do have a form the court system sends out, which requires the person filling it out to indicate that they have all of their physical and mental faculties and that they are not impaired. When they have to list that, they are. Now, that's probably found in the administrative rules where that form is created from on the questionnaire. Some screening does occur just at the clerk's office itself, where they receive indications that people have a bad heart condition, or for some reason it might be taxing on them individually, and they'll be excused. And the court itself often excuses people when letters are written requesting an excuse because of the impairment that they feel themselves will render them not sufficiently able to do it. I think what we're really talking about is the situation where the judge refuses and the attorney is unable to get a juror excused for cause. Would he have to use a peremptory challenge? I think that's an awfully rare situation. I'd rather see those people left in but think they can do a good job and be given the opportunity to demonstrate that.
There is in 09-20 010 the present language would be subsection A, and this would be subsections B and C. And what it says in sub 5 is in possession of the person's natural faculties. And I think that would certainly be read in pari materia, is what it's called with this, or these things would be read together. And if there's some reason that blindness would disqualify them in an individual case, they'd be bumped for cause. I don't think there's.
Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection for the basic reason that unless everything goes totally to put in my life, I don't plan on practicing law again anyway.
I move the bill with
individual. The motion is still before us to move the bill with individual.
So the rest of the lawyers on this table one.
Hearing no objection, the bill will move with individual recommendations.
As amended.
As amended. Actually, in the form of committee, so it's interpreted to be deaf person.
What?
It's interpreters for deaf persons?
Yes, it is.
Bill?
Yes, it is. If you look at the committee substitute,
yeah,
on page 1, lines 14 and 15. Yeah. I'm looking at the committee substitute.
The section called interpreters for deaf. Well, this is a department office or other organization in the state.
Yes. Yeah, we struck that also because that would have carried a large physical note. It was a non-group action.
Okay.
Take a motion.
Okay. The next bill will be Mr. Martin's House Bill 144.
When was this?
I said, is your objection?
I'm sorry.
You're
daydreaming, Randy.
Well,
it's easy. This can
not often look at the bills
today. They've got an opportunity
here. Sorry, that's not the sensitive
side. Let me haggle it out. Side of that one, Coach.
Okay, we have before us now House Bill 144. We have Mr. Martin and also Lisa Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for having a hearing on this bill. And I'd like to bring to the attention the committee substitute from Hal Hess, and I thank the chairman of your committee because these two changes in that bill were mainly at his suggestion, as I concur in. And I think it would fulfill the need that legislators should have as to political contributions and how much money is being spent. Since the discovery of this law, sir, I have written to the Supreme Court and am so honored by being the only one allowed to have this top secret information. And I have the information for 1982, 83, and 84. And I think that I should be allowed to share that with others, but I understand why I asked one person, I said, no, it's just your information, which is ironic. I said, well, I'm going to bring it out at committee hearings pertaining to other things, which really don't matter. I really think we need the bill so that these things, expenditures, any expenditure of the state, becomes a public information.
Mr. Phillips?
Hey, Terry, the question I have is on page 1, line 14, made by the individuals. Does that mean you're going to reveal a person's identity and address, or it's just X person gave $100 to candidate Joe John Doe?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to that question, this is the exact question that Representative Miller brought up in his committee. And originally, the law did say and contained in the name of each resident individual. So we changed that so that the only information I want, and I think that most people would want, as to the candidates and the groups receiving public money. So no, it is not requesting the individual contributors.
The only information would be the names of the candidates or groups that received the money. The donors, their names would not be revealed. A good number of those donors are revealed on the APOC, but people who give less than 100 are not, and those names remain confidential under the terms that we've said.
That's concern I have.
Buck, Chairman, the court order requires the list of the candidates or groups to whom contributions were made. State Affairs Committee substitute adds to that the total amount of credits received by each of those persons. Mm-hmm. Why do you want that?
What's a credit? When do you go back from the election credit? $100.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Martin?
If I may elaborate on that, it's a good point that Representative Clapton brought up. In writing our letter to the Supreme Court, I did not specifically say in the amount. Just by an oversight. I asked for the same list that we had in 1983, which was a voluminous thing of all, 32,000 contributions. And so it was an oversight that we did not say the specific amount, which I could get without any problem the next time. So the department did furnish me the list of 82 and 83, which is easy to calculate how much was giving over the year, but it does not help us in a sense to say how much an individual or a group received. So in relationship to the law as we have it now, that's the most important thing. It was that technicality that the Department of Revenue noted, saying, well, we can't give you the exact amounts. We'll give you how much gave at the end of the year, which they did in a separate report there. But we can't allocate what portion to a political group or a candidate. So it was only a matter of an oversight. In 82, they gave me the exact items right on down the line.
Mr. Fox, if I can stay on that point, I may be confused now. Your original bill would not have required the amounts to be disclosed. The bill was amended by State Affairs to require the amounts to be disclosed. The court order does not require the amounts to be disclosed. You just said something to the effect that if you'd asked, that would have required it. Mm-hmm. That's not very clear.
Well, if you read the Attorney General's letter, sir, he showed that we did not misuse that information in 1982.
State, therefore, does not oppose the application for release of the names of candidates and groups for whom credits were claimed.
Mm-hmm. But that's the same thing. It was an oversight on my part, and I will request next year to the Supreme Court the exact amounts, too. Because when our report comes out on the names and the groups, it's going to be considerably different from what the Department of Revenue gave me as the final fiscal expenditures in those 2 years. So there's a real major gap. In other words, in 1982, they gave me enough names that amounted to 200 $210,000. In 83, they gave me enough names to equal $380,000. In both years, they probably doubled that amount from the fiscal note they showed me. So one doesn't jive over the other, no way. And in my second letter to the Supreme Court, I will specifically, since they were hung up on that, ask for the amount, because that's what we've got to do. No way in the world can APOC's Public Office Commission analyze from the report they were supposed to have gotten, and they haven't. I guess they did last year, but they got a report of the work I did, my staff. And it evidently was turned over to them, and they claimed they got the report, which it wasn't. Not from the Department of Revenue.
Member?
I'm sorry, I'm for a couple minutes here. I gather that if your bill passes, Mr. Martin, what you will be able to obtain from the Public Offices Commission as a private citizen would be, for the name of a particular candidate, how much they received in contributions not exceeding $100 per contribution that people...
Yes, sir.
It would just be a total figure. It wouldn't be broken down by number of contributions.
They could do that. I mean, if we request names like I had now in 83, 16,000 names, I'd go through every one and do my own tally. That's easy to do. And they give a basic figure what the cost is.
But you still don't know how many have gotten credits for their money. This will provide you information so that you can see how many people got reimbursed or how much money was reimbursed by the state for a given candidate.
Not the individual. You only talk about the candidate.
Yes, right.
Yeah, that candidate received X. This political group received X.
I understand.
Well, I think the language to me is a little confusing. On page or line 13, it says, unless containing the total amount of credits received by each candidate, and the candidate doesn't receive credits. The contributors receive credits. The candidate receives contributions.
It should be contributors for each candidate.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out a logical way to say it here.
Yeah, four would be the right. Yeah, you're right. That's a good candidate.
It should be a total amount of credit.
If I could continue, Mr.
Goodman. Go ahead, Mr. Mr. Goodman.
You can criticize what I've done to your merry heart's content. It says, containing the total amount of contributions received by each candidate in group to which a contribution was made by an individual claiming credit. Does that make sense?
But if we said we took out by and put in four, I think it would be all right. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be saying containing the total amount of credits received for each candidate in group to which contributions were made by an individual.
Contributions. Credits received. Mm-hmm. Credits received for contributions made to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Credits received.
You want to go ahead?
Containing the total amount of credits received by an individual for each candidate or group to whom a contribution was to which a contribution was made.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. We don't want the names of the person who contributed less than $100 to become public. I mean, that's
for contributions made to. You want to try the end?
What'd you try?
Containing the total amount of credits made or received for contributions made to each candidate.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Say that again.
Come on.
Well, delete by.
Okay.
And put for, is it contributions?
Made.
Received for contributions
made to each candidate.
Yeah. Keep going, though. You got to fix the rest of the sentence.
I think we ought to send this back to the sponsor, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I see.
Let's refer it back to state.
Getting free legal advice.
I see what you mean.
I'd let us swing point.
I think you could stop after group and eliminate to which a contribution was made by an individual.
Yeah. Let's see how that works.
Contain the total number of credits received for each
contribution made.
Containing the total amount of credits received for contributions made to each candidate and group. Period.
No, under ASS.
Let's not have a track crack out of here. Well, after credits on line 13, just say under AS 4320.
Right. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Get it down.
Under,
that's why one person stayed.
But he gave me a copy last year.
But he came in 29.
Actually, I've searched my mind, I can't imagine why we wrote this the way we did. Got Supreme Court into the act and everything else, so I agree with the dumb thing.
That explains it.
No, I mean, we gave it to the Supreme Court, I'm sure they did that.
In 81, yeah.
In fact, they did, apparently they didn't even know they had the great power until Martin, but. Yeah, okay. I think we all know what we want to do, is there objection to moving the bill conceptually, we'll show you the language before we. Well, here objection to that? Hearing that.
Can we harden it?
Do you object?
No, I didn't actually, no.
I like the way it is right now.
I struck it out, I rewrote it, Randy did it.
Full record by that, the bill is one day.
Well, we're done. We let Randy do the rewrite.
We're done, let me ask a question regarding tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night?
No, I don't think we need to, since I think we can, as long as we've got to come in here Saturday anyway. Do members have meetings at 8:30? You?
Tomorrow morning?
Oh, yeah.
Probably Saturday, what do you think?
Well, we're going to come in for a session anyway, we're not going to call us in on Saturday unless we're coming in for a floor session, but apparently we are. So instead of carrying over that one bill, the gambling bingo bill, tomorrow night, which I announced previously, we'll carry it over instead until Saturday, and I'm trying to determine whether members would rather meet before session and possibly afterwards if we don't finish our business, or whether you just want to do it.
I still before.
Yeah, okay, is 8:30 satisfactory with members?
Nine.
Well, that gives us less than 1 hour, and we're not going to finish that.
Say 8:30, we'll be there at 9.
I recommend 9, that way we will get that bill out.
Quarter to 9.
Okay, okay, sounds great with me, because we've always got after the session if we don't.
How about quarter to 9?
Let's,
quarter to 9?
That bill, I'll call it for 9 o'clock.
Nine.
And that'll be the bingo bill.
Okay.
Good, you can sit tomorrow.
I'd like to hold a hearing on the bingo bill down to A&B Hall.
Are you willing to risk it?
Well, it all depends if you've got an operator.
We have signed the file bill and then.